Dr. Jesse Grumman has been diagnosed with life-threatening conditions 4 times. In her new book, Aftershock, she offers her professional and personal advice on what to do if you or a loved one receives a life-altering diagnosis like HIV, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, or incurable cancer, as in the case of Elizabeth Edwards. Her book is published by Walker, and I'm very pleased to welcome her here. A little later, we'll be taking some of your calls at 212-433-9692. Can you tell us a little bit about your most recent diagnosis?
I was most recently diagnosed when I turned 50. My doctor said, hey, you turned 50, time for you to have a colonoscopy. So I was surprised to wake up to find that in response to a birthday instead of a symptom, I had a serious problem.
But you'd had problems before, so would you perhaps have been better prepared for the possibility of receiving bad news?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote this book was because despite my experience with 3 previous life-altering diagnoses and my expertise as someone who works on consumer health information, I was really taken aback by how this news affected me. Though I wasn't prepared for the wave of emotion, the confusion about kind of how to respond to yet another kind of cancer, I was just awed at the energy it was going to take me to learn about all these new doctors and these new diseases in a body part I just preferred not to know I had in the first place. And then my fear of this very chaotic and unaccountable medical care system. So experience, expertise kind of didn't seem to help me out of that one.
Usually when you have cancer, you're mostly worried about it metastasizing. But this was a different kind of cancer.
Well, double worry. Yeah, it was. And it was one of the, I kind of feel like, well, I've given it the office, you know. I mean, I shouldn't have to go through this again, a whole different kind of cancer. And there's no reason to believe that these cancers, at least as far as the physicians I've talked to are concerned, there's no reason to believe that these cancers are related to one another. So I'm just always waiting for yet another shoe to drop, you know.
I know some people who will put off a colonoscopy precisely because they're afraid of getting bad news. Can you sympathize with that?
You know, I can. I definitely can, but I'm the poster child now for doing it on time. You know, the notion that if I had put off getting my colonoscopy for as long as I think I probably would have if I hadn't had somebody just make that appointment for me could have meant the difference in my life and death is enough to make me sympathize with people who want to put it off, but only to a certain extent. It's just not that big a deal.
Well, Elizabeth Edwards talked about having a heightened awareness that every time you have a slight pain, you know, you have to make another doctor's appointment, the kind of pain that anybody else would say, oh, it'll just go away.
Oh, you know, I think you can talk to almost anybody, certainly, who's undergone cancer treatment. You know, a headache translates into a brain tumor almost immediately, and it takes years for that anxiety to calm down. There's always this kind of sense of vigilance that, you know, I don't get a cold, I get cancer.
Well, you've had 4 a terrible diagnoses, but you didn't think of writing a book until this last one.
No, it never entered my mind. I'm not the kind of person who actually reads books or learns particularly well about how to make my way through my illness through books, but I was just so taken aback, not by the whole process of, being ill, but just by the incredible demands that are placed on us during the first few weeks. There's no time in your life when it's more important to gather and make really good use of good information, but there's no time in your life when you feel less able to do it, and you're making so many decisions that are so important for the whole future of your life in those very few weeks.
You're going from 0 to 60 almost immediately.
Almost immediately.
And how much do you suggest people learn? I mean, with the internet now, you can get on to Google and find out almost everything about any kind of medical condition, including some of the most the latest research in the field. You can find out about all of the drug trials that are involved. Some people might actually be over-educating themselves.
Well, I think people vary widely in their preference for their interest in information. Some people want only... Well, they would actually prefer that somebody else learn these things about their illness, and then other people want really to know the molecular structure of their sarcoma. Some of us vary in between, but what's important is that for those people who really want to know everything, that they have a guide to really find the best information first and then to expand after that. As they learn more about their own diagnosis, they can personalize that information. At the beginning, it just feels overwhelming. But on the other hand, if you're one of those people like I am a little bit, that I don't really want to know very much about my illness, you still, in this day and age, you can't afford to know nothing. You have to know some very basic things. So what I tried to do in the book was to give people a middle path and say, if you don't want to know very much, here's what you need to know and how to find it out. And if you want to know a lot, here are some choices of places to start.
What do you have your PhD in?
I'm a social psychologist with an interest in health.
So you obviously have spoken to other people who have faced similar problems, haven't you?
Yeah, I started writing this book with the idea that my own four experiences was sufficient data on which to base the book. And I talked to a couple of other people, and I realized very soon after that the variety of experiences and the variety of responses is so great that I really needed to get a good handle on this. And I ended up talking to over 200 people and family members of people who had had devastating diagnoses.
My guest is Jessie Grumman, G-R-U-M-A-N, her book Aftershock, What to Do When the Doctor Gives You or Someone You Love a Devastating Diagnosis, available now in paperback from Walker & Company. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And so as a result of speaking to all these people, I imagine you include personal accounts from others who have been faced with life-altering diagnoses. But they gave you personal notes as well. Did you find that most people were willing to share those intimate experiences with you?
Asking people to talk to me about this time in their lives was very interesting. Most people, when I approached them to talk with me, said, well, let me tell you the story. And they would start telling me the story from the time that they started getting treatment. So they would tell me the story, and then I would say, well, so now let's talk about the very first day. And it was very hard for them to go back there, for many of them. And it was hard for them to reconstruct this time, I think in part because you're so confused and you're so upset. The memories just don't fall together in a way that kind of forms an easy narrative. I have to say that I was so... first of all, that there were a number of people who said, I can't talk about that time because it was just too painful. But I am so grateful to those who were willing to excavate those painful memories and trust me to transform their experience into words that could be helpful to other people.
Some people are afraid to even reveal that they have a condition like this. I know someone who really would love to write a book, but knows that it would affect his career and doesn't really feel it would be a good idea to write it under a false name and all the rest, because then you kind of undermine your credibility.
Right. Well, the varieties of response to illness go along almost every dimension. Some people want to know a lot of information. Some people want to know a little. Some people want to announce their illness to the world. I talked to a college president who said, I'm a field marshal kind of person, and I wanted all of the support and affection that I could get. That really helped me. I talked to somebody else who said, I had just started a company, and if my board knew that I had this disease, I would no longer have a business. My career would be ruined. And then everywhere in between, some people work in workplaces that have a history of being very supportive of people who are ill, and they have a lot of flexibility. But others, if you are working in a workplace that's hostile to people who are ill, you know that, and you know that you have to be very protective of yourself and information about yourself.
And then there are people who go to support groups and others who say, I'm not a joiner, I don't do that sort of thing.
That's right. Well, it's very interesting. I talked to everybody about support groups, and everybody had a lot of opinions, as you noted, about support groups. But during the very initial phases of the illness, and this book really is about the first 2 or 3 weeks after you get your diagnosis, most people are kind of hoping that they don't have to go to a support group because they're really hoping that they don't really have this disease in the first place and that it's not going to be
It's all a big mistake.
It's just a mistake. And the other thing is that usually when people are in support groups, they're talking about how to manage advanced disease. They're not talking about how do you incorporate this into your life. And I actually have found some places that were not hostile to people who had just been diagnosed, but had forgotten what it was like and were kind of impatient with people's, oh, my God, I have this illness. And they would be competitive and say, you only have that? Well, I have this. And it was very kind of off-putting. So during those first few weeks, people tended to steer away from support groups.
Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-9692 if you'd like to join in this conversation. And we will respect your desire for anonymity if you ask for it. 212-433-9692. Jesse, do you think that in general the issues surrounding a life-changing diagnosis are the same? For example, outside of the specifics of the diseases, does a patient diagnosed with cancer have to face the same kind of shock and decision-making as someone who's diagnosed with multiple sclerosis?
I found that there were a few people who didn't experience much shock at all. One person who told me, you know, I had a child die at 19 in a car accident, and nothing will be as shocking as that. And she was cruising through her pancreatic cancer without shock. But for the most part, that initial point when the plans that you had are gone, it kind of transcends diseases. And the reason that I said a moment before that this book is only really about the first 2 or 3 weeks is because after 2 weeks, the whole disease and what's going to happen to you and your personal process of figuring out how to respond to this is starting to unfold. And then the book about multiple sclerosis or pancreatic cancer or ALS or HIV, then that stuff is very, very helpful because then the path is more known.
So you learn about the condition and the treatments after you get past the shock. But then you have to make all sorts of decisions. Should you involve other people? How do you find a good doctor in a hospital? How are you going to pay for this whole thing? Should you go for a second opinion? Can you find the time to go undergo serious medical treatments if you have a job and your boss is going to wonder why you're disappearing for hours at a time?
Right.
Have I listed the most important ones?
Yeah, those are all things that you must make a decision. That's part of the 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. Those are all decisions that you must make early on in the process of getting your disease, after getting your diagnosis. And each one of those decisions has implications for how you live the rest of your life.
Now, I assume that doctors, I spoke to Jerome Groupman recently, mm-hmm. that they are the best at doing this because they already know, they can cut through the medical jargon and the gobbledygook. But what about the rest of us? Is it important for me, if I discover I have some illness of this sort, to know enough so that I can talk to a doctor on a level that is sophisticated? Will the doctor respect me more? Will the doctor perhaps give me better advice as a result, be more open with me?
I talked to a number of people who really felt that for whom it was very important to be feeling like they were absolute partners in their care with their doctor, and that the work that they did to stay up to date on their or to get current on what were the right treatments was one of the most important things that they did. I have to say that this was not the case during the first 2 or 3 weeks. During the first 2 or 3 weeks, your ability, because you're you're under such stress, your ability to absorb the mountain of complex information that you would need to learn in order to actually understand not only your disease but the context in which it exists, and then to look at the most recent studies and understand what they are relative to the other studies, is just such a monumental task that it's simply not possible to take it on. It is important to have this very basic knowledge about what is this disease, what is it, what body part is it located, what is its trajectory, what does my disease look like relative to others, what are the, you know, what's the time course for this, what's the urgency of treatment. That's another issue that many people, almost everyone talked about after getting their diagnosis, was this urgency to do something immediately, which in some people really goes to war with their desire to know everything immediately, because they want to take care of it. If it's MS, they want to start their interferon tomorrow. If it's cancer, they want to start their treatment. They want to have surgery tomorrow. Because it, just as that diagnosis came into their life and destroyed their plans, they hope that it can disappear and they can go back to the life they had before.
But something like interferon is so toxic, it really, some people can't even survive a year of treatment.
But if you hook on to that thing as the thing that is going to make your life the way it was before. This, I'm not saying this is rational. I'm just saying that we have this urgency to resolve what's going on. I talked to people who rushed from getting a cancer diagnosis into surgery, and were really sorry that they did. One person managed to schedule surgery 2 days later, only to find that the original diagnosis wasn't the right one, and spent months recovering from poor surgery.
On the other hand, I know someone who worried that waiting a month and a half for surgery meant that the cancer was going to grow and that it would be a lot worse than it might have been otherwise. Couldn't metastasize.
Well, that certainly is part of the thing that's feeding our urgency. If you're not in the hospital, it's highly likely that you have a couple of weeks to put this together and to get some information to make sure that the person who's going to do your surgery or is going to do your continue on your diagnosis, that this is the right one for you. You have a little time.
My guest is Jessie Grumman. Her book, Aftershock, What to Do When the Doctor Gives You or Someone You Love a Devastating Diagnosis. It is published by Walker. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we're back with Jessie Grumman. Her book, Aftershock, What to Do When the Doctor Gives You or Someone You Love a Devastating Diagnosis. It is published by Walker. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And Catherine, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, hi, Catherine.
Hi.
We have a very bad connection here, Catherine.
How is this better?
Much better. Go ahead.
Yes, I was listening to this woman describe her shock, and I had the shock myself. If you want to start that in 1997. What provoked me to call is that I have not admitted to this, even though I'm out of the woods since 2001. If somebody tells me that they'd had it, I never admit I did. And this recent episode with Elizabeth Edwards has also brought up the fact that I did go through diagnosis, horrible experiences with the surgery, a year of treatment, and I was in a career that I could have lost since I was a model, and I faced physical disfigurement. So what would be helpful is that I sought out a nurse and a good friend to help me choose the right surgeon, who decided against mastectomy, thank God.
But, Catherine, why have you kept it secret all these years? I mean, not that you shouldn't have, but were there very strong reasons? Was it professional?
Well, I was afraid of anybody knowing and ruining my career, because in the fashion business, they're not very sympathetic. They'll be afraid, your body's not right.
You know, I have been impressed with all of the media about Elizabeth Edwards' recurrence, and understand that this probably raises these issues among many of us who have had lots of who have been diagnosed and are now thinking about, well, should we have done that? Should we have responded that way? And you know, one of the things that is really important to remember is that each of us is responding with such a different complex set of concerns. There is no right way to respond. There is no single thing that works for every person. Each of us has family and history and our own disease and our job and our family and our needs for support and information or our desire to do this on our own.
Or spouses who have ambitions, as in the case of Elizabeth Edwards. And will you mess up that opportunity, or as some people are accusing her, will you bring in a sympathy vote, which, you know, horrifies others?
Well, you know, I find that her desire, I can hear her speaking as a completely private person in every word that she says, because in some ways you're so naked when you're talking about this kind of thing. But at the same time, people are holding her up as a public person, as a role model. So on one hand, she's talking about this very private decision and saying things like, we made the choice to live. We don't want to be surrounded by a veil of tears. Well, all of us make a choice to live. We just make different choices. There are many ways to respond to this. And, you know, the way that you responded is probably the best way you possibly could to preserve your privacy and your dignity and your career.
Thank you for calling us, Catherine. Sue from Newark, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Sue.
Hi. I called in because I was recently diagnosed of having Alzheimer's, and I'm only 50 years old, and I just found out about 6 months ago. And it's the way it's affected me. It's like, I mean, it's really, at a relatively young age, I've had to stop working. And I have two young children that, you know, I hope that I'm going to be of some kind of sound mind and body for some time to experience life with them and help them out. And it's really a really scary thing to go through.
How did you even discover that you have early stages of Alzheimer's?
I guess it started a couple of years ago. I had a series of like dizzy spells, and I had the strange kind of symptom where a cloud would come over me, and I'd be sort of very confused. And so after some time, I eventually went to a doctor and to a neurologist, and eventually he did what's called a PET scan, which is like a mapping of your brain, and it showed that I had proteins attack different parts of the brain, and that's what I know about it.
Now, what is the prognosis? Because you sound perfectly fine.
I do. I mean, in terms of my day-to-day experience, I am forgetful about a lot of things, and I'm just in the process of, I'm going to attend this Alzheimer's seminar through the Alzheimer's Association, particularly for early onset of Alzheimer's, which is what I have. I sound like pretty clear-headed and everything, but I am definitely affected in terms of my memory and in terms of the flow of my day and things getting confused. I wouldn't trust myself to go on I still drive and everything, but I wouldn't trust myself to go to an unknown location because I could easily get lost.
That sounds like a very tough diagnosis and one that must have shocked you incredibly.
Yeah, it did. And, one of the hardest parts of it is like thinking I want to be there. I have an 11-year-old and 8-year-old daughter.
Right.
I want to be there for them.
What about talking to them about it? A lot of parents are afraid to say too much, especially when a child is young, for fear of traumatizing the child, of putting too much of a burden on the child.
Well, I've talked to both of my daughters are aware of my condition, and at times I can tell when it's hard for them to deal with it, and at other times they know what's going on, and, you know, so they can say, okay, Mom, you know, like, they'll help me. So it's sort of twofold. I mean, I don't come down heavy on it because obviously I don't want them to be, like, you know, devastated.
Right.
But for me, you know, thinking about the prospects ahead, it's a really scary thing. So all I can say is that I have really strong support with my family in general, my brothers and sisters, and my mom who's still alive. And then I'm going to go to this Alzheimer's conference that's especially for early onset, and I'm just going to have to, like, I have to try and stay as much in the moment as possible.
Well, it sounds like you've made decisions to really pull from all parts of your life to help you kind of move forward in the way that works for you, which is really the thing that all of us do or need to do, is to realize that each of our journeys is different. Each of us bring different resources, but that it's not, you know, it's not a problem that's solved immediately. It becomes a problem throughout our life. It's what we do.
What about the problems for the other people, in her case, her children, or maybe a spouse? There's an odd situation. It's tough for the other person to watch you go through that, to deal with some of these issues, and yet at the same time, a lot of guilt if the spouse complains.
Well, you know, this is related a little bit, again, to the Elizabeth Edwards discussion that's going on. Her spouse said, you know, you can work or you don't have to work, and I can work or I don't have to work. Most people in this country don't have that choice. Most of us get our health insurance through our work, and we must work, and our spouses must work in order for us to continue to be able to pay for medical care.
And then they talk about maintaining some kind of an optimistic viewpoint, because that'll make you healthier, whatever that means. I know you're making a face right now. But when you start calling some of those HMOs to try to get basic services when you are facing a life-threatening situation, I'd imagine that can get you pretty down.
It can get you pretty down. I think that there is this sense that all of us should be hopeful at all times. And I know this caller and our previous caller and many people who are listening know that hope is a gift, and that you don't get it all the time and you don't get it every day.
Let's go to, is it Kime?
It's Kame.
Kame. Hi, Kame. You're on the air.
I'm 30 years old, and just 2 months ago, I was diagnosed with colorectal cancer, and it was very shocking. And the first thing that ran through my mind was that my life is over.
Right.
I mean, the first thing I pictured when the doctor told me that the CAT scan results had come up with cancer was envisioning my own funeral.
Right.
And then immediately I flushed to the idea that I was uninsured, and pretty much the whole checklist of which you're going through.
Right. Yeah. And what was your next step?
My next step was to reassess where I was, location-wise, because I was in California, and I had to backpedal back to the East Coast to my family for that support, which has been tremendous.
You're very fortunate to have a family who can provide that for you.
Yeah, I definitely understand that.
Yeah, you know, I talked to this wonderful Chilean nurse who said, apropos of, you know, asking for help or contacting your family or telling other people, be very careful before you make the decision to tell no one. Be careful not to cut off the support that you're going to need to go through this. And it sounds like you really are drawing heavily on and are fortunate to have good support.
Well, at first I was very hesitant to tell anybody, because I didn't want to tell anybody about the diagnosis until it was rock solid, confirmed that
right.
It was cancer.
Right.
Because I didn't want to unnecessarily confuse people or worry them.
Yeah.
Now, is this inoperable?
It is inoperable right now. It's stage 4, And it's very uncommon for someone my age to have stage 4 colon cancer.
Right.
We should explain stage 4 is the final stage.
Yeah.
It's an very advanced stage.
And there are drug trials that are available. Are there any things available to you?
I am currently on chemotherapy with a certain drug called Erbitux.
Yeah.
And it's been fairly effective. Like, as you can hear my voice right now, when I first came from California, my voice would have been almost unintelligible.
Were you that ill?
I was in severe pain. Almost all the time.
You know, this is you and the previous caller both talked about something that I think is really interesting, and that is the this long process that some of us go through until we finally get diagnosed. And on one hand, the diagnosis can be a relief because it's the end of having to find out what is causing this thing. But it can often be a real shock because of the true meaning. You go from being a sick person to being a sick person with a disease that has very clear implications about the length of your life or your prospects, and that's a big shock on top of the pain of all of those months of trying to figure out what's going on.
I once spoke to a medical researcher about the problems of drug trials for people in stage 4, where they use placebos to test the efficacy. If you're stage 4, it seems to me medical science should make some kind of adjustment and not be giving you a sugar pill.
Well, stage 4 trials or clinical trials in stage 4 give you the best available treatment that there's proof for, and test that against the new possible drugs. So I guess I have some sympathy with the process, if for no other reason knowing that sometimes stage 4 drug trials test drugs that don't work, and so you need to have a backup there.
Now, your situation is kind of similar to Keir May's, isn't it?
No.
The caller, Kimei. The caller we just had.
Uh-huh.
What is your prognosis right now?
My prognosis is good. I'm, as far as I know, it's good right now.
Mm-hmm.
As of 2 o'clock today, my prognosis is good. I haven't... I am clear, as far as I know.
Well, our hearts go out to all of the people who've called in, and we could not get to everyone because we just didn't want to give short shrift to the people we talked to. But we hope that medical science comes up with some miracle cures really soon. And my special thanks to Jesse Grumman, whose book, Aftershock, What to Do When the Doctor Gives You or Someone You Love a Devastating Diagnosis, is published by Walker Books in paperback now.
In paperback, yes.
And I'm sure that you're getting incredible responses to this book because it just affects so many people.
It does affect far more people than any of us ever thought. And it also is a book that's good for family members and people who are going through this with another person.
On tomorrow's show, John Kerry and Teresa Hines Kerry talk about their campaign to make the environment a national priority. Also, why New York City's bee population may be healthier than the one in the countryside. Plus, a disturbing report from a travel writer who went undercover as an airport screener for 2 months. And record and film producer Joe Boyd tells us about his eventful life working with the likes of Muddy Waters, Bob Dylan, Pink Floyd, and Nick Drake. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Nee-Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angie Sheldon, William Jones, and Brad Ludlow. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.